This is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco, sports director for Civic Media. Right now, we're airing a Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks game over the air, but due to our rights agreements, we're not able to stream those games here. Civic Media might be a newer company, but we are dedicated to providing the best in sports coverage. Our team has decades of experience covering sports right here in Wisconsin. We've got Mike Clemens, who covers our state's biggest teams on location and does daily updates on all of our Civic Media stations statewide. Many of our stations have local reporters dedicated to teams in their area, covering their community dozens or even hundreds of times each year. No matter where you're at in Wisconsin, we are committed to covering sports, especially in the communities that our stations serve. And we put all of our local coverage right here on our stream, so you can go ahead and grab the free Civic Media app so you never miss a game at civicmedia.us/app. You can find the game you're looking for over the air, or you can stay tuned right here on the stream for more news, talk, and conversation. Thank you for listening to Civic Media from all of us here on the sports team.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Badgers host Illinois. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports, men's college basketball. It's Wisconsin against Illinois tonight at the Kohl Center in Madison. The Badgers now ranked 11th in the nation after beating Purdue. Greg Gard says his team is better now at managing the shot clock.
That's important. I think it just shows the growth of this team. They couldn't make that play in October or November. They weren't accustomed, I think, to playing together as comfortable as they are right now.
We've learned that Marcus Sedbury is the new general manager of the Badgers football program. Sedbury has served as assistant athletic director at Wisconsin the past 3 years. He'll handle the players and coaches' contracts. Baseball, Brewers left-handed pitcher Nestor Cortes is at spring training in Arizona, trying to learn everyone's name in the clubhouse after 5 years with the Yankees.
Yeah, the names is going to be tough. Obviously, being, you know, so many years in another organization, Gold Glove caliber defense, and as a pitcher, that's what you want, so I'm very excited for that.
That's Brewers pitcher Nestor Cortes with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Ever tried balancing a dozen eggs in one hand while hopping on one foot? Or maybe juggling cats while riding the unicycle? Sounds ridiculous, right? But guess what? That's exactly what texting while driving is like. Your human brain only has the capacity to focus on one thing at a time. So when you're behind the wheel, give driving your undivided attention.
Don't drive distracted. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Listen to sports coverage from Mike Clemens on Civic Media stations all across Wisconsin.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. The chaos doth continue. Yes, if now that we're firing air traffic controllers. Yeah, why not? After you had the debacle there in D.C., you got a plane flipped over in Toronto. Yeah, great, great timing. And look, this is, the dismantling of our government and all of the functions of government. So why be surprised? And look, I had a reporter friend reach out to me for a comment. He said, well, what do you think? I go, elections have consequences. This is the consequence of electing people who tell you we're just going to run the government like a business, and having Elon Musk at the front of that business. Now, Elon Musk, a guy who, this is one of those funny memes that are running around. You know, women are posting, you know, if I was, you know, 50 some years old and had, you know, a bunch of kids by, you know, a bunch of different people, you know, would people look at me kindly? No. But evidently Musk's got like a football team full of kids. Nobody can tell me exactly how many. And I guess if you're worth $500 billion, you know, paternity suits don't really, I guess, matter. But evidently the latest woman to come out and say that Elon is the father of her child. Evidently, he's not. He's not. He's not taking responsibility. And this is what I love from conservatives, because, you know, they talk about family values, they talk about, you know, responsibility, all that stuff, and they get behind people who are just dirtbags. And what bothers me is the number of people who have reached out to me recently and go, you know, what's your problem with Donald Trump and Elon Musk? They're just doing what's in the best interest of the country. They're just auditing the books. And I go, well, you know, if they were just auditing the books, you know, you would have accountants. You would have people who know what they're looking at instead of coders who are just there to, you know, grab data and slip in some code. You would be doing this a lot differently. You would be in there with a scalpel, not a hatchet. And it would be going a bit differently. But they keep coming back, well, you never say anything nice about Donald Trump. And I go, well, there's not a lot nice to say about the man. I agree with some of his trade stuff. I agree that the U.S. has been taken advantage of for a very long time. But I was saying that long before Donald Trump was on the scene. I was against trade deals before it was cool to be against trade deals. I was against neoliberalism before it was cool to be against neoliberalism. Most of the stuff that we're living through right now, I was saying, bad idea 20 years ago. So when the blind squirrel finds the nut, which Donald Trump stole from Bernie Sanders, I go, okay, yeah, I want to take on China. I think if we're going to have a future in this country, you got to have a manufacturing base. But you don't do it with Elon Musk, whose belief structure is we don't need people anymore. So, you know, when someone asks me, well, what do you think of Donald Trump? What don't you like about him? Other than everything, other than the fact that he has no class, no couth, no decency, no humanity, no honor, you know, no wisdom, no compassion, no sympathy, no empathy, none of that. Other than that, I love the guy. Other than the fact that I don't ever think I've heard him say a funny thing, because everything that he says is at someone else's expense. A good joke is funny. I love a good joke, but not when you're punching down. You know, he's a bully. He's always been a bully, and he's always picked on the weak. And I find it amazing that in a country that feels that they've been wronged somehow, they choose a freaking bully who caused their problems as their hero. A troll who's never funny, never interesting, just insults people and is crude and rude. But what's not to love about that? The sad reality is what we've got is a guy who's used to kicking people when they're down. Kicking the downtrodden. We used to be a country that fought for the little guy. We used to be a country that stood up for someone who was being bullied. We used to unite around people like Elon, around to defeat people like Elon Musk. We used to unite around people like Donald Trump to take them on, not to march with them. And this is where I keep coming back to my frustration of where we are in this country and why, as I said from the beginning, elections have consequences and we're going to have to take our medicine. Because maybe then we'll, the old labor frame, when your stomach's empty, your head gets right. Maybe that's what it has to come to. And I've said that from the beginning. So for all of my reporter friends who, hey, do you have a quote? That's always going to be my quote. Elections have consequences. We got a large number of people in this country got bamboozled into believing that their hatred and their disdain of others was going to make their lives better. And it's not. It's going to make Elon Musk's life better. It's going to make Donald Trump wealthier. But a spoiled rich kid as your savior? Oh, but he's going to run things like a business, Rick. Yeah, well, what you're seeing is you're seeing slash and burn business. You're seeing an abusive business. You're seeing what happens when a bully can do whatever he wants. And look, are the Democrats standing up? No, I don't think so. If they were, we would see every night on the 5 o'clock news or the 6 o'clock news, Democrats are filibustering again. Democrats have shut down Congress again. Democrats are have a alternative budget talking about how they're going to make lives better. They've got an idea to raise the minimum wage. They got an idea to not undo OSHA, but to strengthen OSHA. They've got an idea to help labor rights, not to allow Elon and Bezos and the rest of them to destroy the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, but no, a plan to make it better so that workers can form unions, can join unions without fear of, well, Musk and Trump and Bezos and the bully class. Because now we have given them all this wealth, because we keep voting for idiots who keep cutting their taxes so they can continue to grow enormous amounts of wealth that then the idiots who voted for it have to go back to and beg for. Because we, the working people, we've been getting stiffed for decades. And the anger's right. The anger's righteous and real. It's just where you're putting your hope and your dreams and your solutions. That's crazy to me. But again, elections have consequences, and this is what it looks like. Want to hear your thoughts. Am I wrong? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Scott Paul from the Alliance for American Manufacturing is going to be here.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, new Reuters article out titled U.S. Manufacturing Production Unexpectedly Fell in January and weighed down by the sharp decline in motor vehicle output. And you go, I don't know, the uncertainty of the new administration coming in, slashing and burning all the investments that Biden made into EVs and battery technology, and the whole direction the country was moving toward vehicle production and the industry as well, I don't know, may have had a little bit to do with it. And now you've got Trump saying, hey, come April, some new tariffs are coming on autos. And is that a good thing? Look, I'm, as I've said before, not against tariffs if they're strategically done, if there's a plan, if there's an end game, if it's just another tool in the bag to get us where we need to go, I'm in favor of it. Sadly, I don't think he's got a plan, but here to share some thoughts on, well, all of this and, well, Project 2025 / Made in China 2025. I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come share some thoughts. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website, if you want to check out the amazing work that they do. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is great to be with you.
So what do you make of this unexpected? Because they're saying it's unexpected. We didn't expect the bottom to fall out of the manufacturing of autos, and thus causing the entire manufacturing sector to sink. What do we make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is something that you raised up, which was the uncertainty. There's no doubt about that. And part of that's on the producer side. Part of that's on the consumer side. Are the EV tax credits going to be there? You know, are the imports going to have tariffs? A lot of questions. And then I would also say that, you know, there's been some ongoing things, just in fairness to whoever is the president, right? Because Biden was the president for most of January. But, it still costs a lot to get a car loan, right? And, the auto prices are still, you know, they're not what they used to be.
You know,
they're a little more expensive, right?
Not a little.
A lot more expensive. So you had that, and then, you know, you have a lot of people. I imagine every federal worker was probably like, well, is this a good time to buy an automobile? Probably not, right? And so there's a lot in that mix. And so, yeah, I do hope that we get into a better place. I mean, there is reason to believe, and I know that when you look at, you know, if you listen to the industry analysts and the Federal Reserve Bank, they do think 2025 could be a decent year for auto sales, for auto production in the United States. We'll see about that. But yeah, it was obviously a little disconcerting to see kind of a step back.
Yeah, look, I agree. Biden was president for January, but understand, you knew all of November, December, and into January what was coming, and I think a lot of people understood what was coming and held back. I think this is the Trump effect in action, because they were expecting things to be okay, not great, but okay, and well, not so much. But it brings me to in April, if Trump does raise tariffs on auto imports, which I got to tell you, I'm not 100% opposed to, what will that mean for auto manufacturing in the U.S.?
Well, I think it'll mean two things. That, you know, anybody who's an importer is going to try to bring a bunch of cars in over the next 2 months to try to get ahead of the tariffs. But it also means, and I think this is true, is that when you combine, and I'll call it like the Sean Fain effect, with tariffs, you know, it could potentially say, hey, we're gonna ramp up some production in the United States. I mean, all of this is speculative, but I know, you know, Sean Fain, part of what he was able to do with Stellantis and what have you is like, look, you know, let's forego the investments in Mexico. Let's do the cars in the United States. And Stellantis for a long time said, no, we're not going to do it. And then there is this threat, right, of tariffs. And so, you know, now they've made that commitment. And I don't think that this is any, you know, act of genius on the part of Donald Trump. But I do think that it does show that tariffs are a powerful incentive. And let's use a Biden example. There's a reason why there are not a whole lot of Chinese imported cars in the United States. And that's because Joe Biden has put into place a 100% tariff on Chinese automobiles or any automobiles that were made in China in the United States. So it's likely to stay that way for a while. And just the last thing I'll say about our car market is that we are pretty unique around the world, Rick, where, you know, if you look at all of the cars imported everywhere in the world, the United States consumer, we're responsible for 46% of that import consumption globally. Right. Globally, we have 5% of the population, and we're responsible for 46% of the consumption of car imports. And it's certainly not like that in Europe. It's definitely not like that in Japan or Korea or China, right? It's not like that in any of those places. And so that does make us a little unique. And why did this happen? This was years, and I know we've talked about this, but this was decades of policy that said, you know what? We don't care if you guys, you know, move those factories abroad or import. There won't be a real penalty. And so, you know, to your point, depending on how it's structured, the tariffs could be a powerful tool. But you also have the right circumstance. You have to have the right circumstances here at home. You have to make sure that people have good wages so they can afford cars. You have to make sure that we aren't leaving the automakers like Ford and GM with a bunch of half-built battery and EV plants, because suddenly Trump says we're not going to do this anymore, and that would be a massive cost to those companies.
Well, what this tells us, I mean, 46% of the cars end up here. It says, you know, Americans are the consumer of last resort. This is the dumping ground for the world to create their wealth. And look, the argument is, well, we get cheaper stuff. I don't know if it's cheaper, to be honest, because it doesn't look that much cheaper. I've always been a supporter, and I've told you this a million times, I'm a big believer in domestic production for domestic consumption. The stuff we want, we should be able to build here. And if you want to be part of this market, you build it here. It makes no sense to me shipping things all over the world in bits and pieces and creating this hodgepodge of a supply chain that doesn't seem to really benefit us in any real way other than making the wealthy wealthier.
That's right. And so you raise a good point here. and this is so true with automobiles, is that, you know, our factories in the United States almost exclusively make automobiles for this market. A few of them are exported, okay, but it is a pretty small amount relative to other countries. And as we just discussed, we're very open to these imports coming in, particularly, you know, sedans and things like that from Europe and from Japan. We have a very integrated North American market because of the USMCA. So there's lots of Canadian and Mexican cars that are made by GM and Stellantis and Ford that are coming into the U.S. as well. But it's because we designed the system to work that way. And so it will take, I think, a pretty sophisticated set of policy tools that do include tariffs, right, strategically applied to turn that around. But yet, like, we haven't learned our own lesson. I guess that's the thing. It's like, you know, I love exactly what you said. Like, you know what, if a company wants to sell into the Chinese market and they want to open a factory there, and so long as it's not with Uyghur labor, fine, I guess go ahead and do it, as long as we're not subsidizing it. I guess I don't really have a problem with that. And so, but we should expect the same thing, basically.
Yeah, well, you don't get to move that factory, Scott.
Should make it here.
Yeah, but you don't get to move that factory. And I remember the arguments, you know, 20 years ago, that GM was building a $2 billion production plant. And everyone that, you know, talked about it said, look, they're just going to build them there and ship them back here because there's going to be no demand really for GM cars because the people don't want them. And this is where I keep coming back to us as consumers going, I just want the cheapest thing. And not caring about, is this going to employ my neighbor? Is it going to employ myself? Is this, you know, we hear a lot of rhetoric about, you know, America first, but while we're driving around in our foreign cars.
Yeah. Well, that is true. You got to look at the, yeah, you look at the make and model of some of those cars. You're like, really? Okay. Let's back our sayings with our purchases as well. And so I guess what does give me some hope here, I guess, is that I do believe that Biden recognized this, right? Who was our last president? You know, Trump, you know, did apply some tariffs and, you know, didn't negotiate any new free trade agreements. And so, you know, the direction of the trade policy is headed in the right direction. Trump's way more open to deals than Biden was, right, for the sake of making a deal. And so we have to keep an eye on that. But the direction of trade policy is good. And so this is what I guess disturbs me, is that, look, I get if people are upset, rightly so, about the price of eggs or potentially raising the prices of groceries that are imported because the you know, the produce is in season or whatever. I totally get that. But progressives and others, just because it's a Trump policy on tariffs, shouldn't be reflexively against it. Like a 10% tariff on Chinese products, I'm all for that.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm all for that. And so when I see our lawmakers who are Democrats or some of the groups, just because Trump did it, say, oh, no, this has got to be bad. I'm like, well, OK, that's not necessarily the case. And remember whose idea it was in the first place. Who was fighting against NAFTA? And who was fighting against putting China into the WTO? It was the labor movement. It was the progressives who were doing that. Those are the folks who were voting against it. And so, you know, my hope is that the new generation of progressives will understand that, instead of just saying, because he's for it, I'm against it automatically. We got to reclaim some of that because that originally was our idea.
Yep.
Our opposition, you know, and so you can't let like one ideology just overtake that and then say, okay, well, I'm going to do the other thing.
Yeah, all these years of these free trade agreements, I keep asking, you know, define what is trade. Look, if we're trading things, when I was a kid, we used to trade baseball cards. You know, I understood, you know, I trade you this card, you give me this card. That's trading. We're just buying things that used to be made here that are now made somewhere else. That's not trading. That's not trade in my book. That's just buying something from a place that gets much cheaper labor, much more exploitable labor regulations, and all of the negatives. And we get lower wages and garbage. And to me, that's not where we're at. But here's the thing. You know, all during the campaign, we heard about Project 2025, and we're living through, as we talked about, you know, Project 2025. They're actually doing it. It was their playbook. But China, they had their own playbook. And for the last decade, it was Made in China 2025. I know what Republicans and Trump are doing with Project 2025. How'd the Chinese do with Made in China 2025? How'd that playbook work out for them, and at whose expense?
Yeah, and just quick background for your listeners. You know, every 5 years, China does a five-year plan, and it is an economic plan. And they're like, this is what we're going to invest on. These are our goals. And it's very strategic. And so back in 2015, China said, we want to dominate the world in electric vehicles, in shipbuilding, in biotechnology, and in a lot of other, in telecommunications, AI, and a bunch of other industries. And we're going to invest in them. We're going to invest in big companies. We're going to invest in small companies. We're going to have policies that are going to ensure that we're winning in third markets. They're going to gain us access. And we'll also help these companies destroy their competitors who are global as well. And guess what? It worked. it is like shipbuilding. You know, no one builds more ships than China. No, it doesn't even come close to that. Same with some types of those technology applications as well. And so it goes when you look and EVs. I mean, China is dominating in EVs, and BYD, a Chinese company, just overtook Tesla as like the largest EV maker. So, so this is happening. I mean, from their perspective, it was quite a successful strategy. And look, I'm okay if a company or if a country says, I want to have these goals, these economic goals, and I want to reach them. The problem is when it comes at the expense of the general welfare of other countries. And that's the problem with Made in China 2025. It's like, we not only want to dominate the world in this, we want to vanquish everybody else. And so the question is, do you let them or do you not let them? And I think, right? And I think at the very end of the Obama administration, they kind of understood that, you know what, just negotiating with the Chinese probably wasn't the way to go. We probably needed to take tougher action. And so, you know, you've seen that again progressively since 2016. And, you know, this was true in the first Trump administration to some extent, certainly true in the Biden administration, trying to tighten things up a little more. And we're in the very early days still, not even a month in, right? Wow. It seems like a year, but
it
not
seems like forever, doesn't it?
Not even a month into this administration. I was like, how long has it been? We do have a 10% tariff on Chinese products, but we're going to see what else is coming down the pike in March and April on all of this. And that's going to be very important. But that is one of the problems, is that China, you know, was able to reach a lot of these goals that they set out. And again, I don't think we ought to be emulating that necessarily. But the response to that certainly shouldn't be Project 2025. It does need to be some combination of a more muscular industrial policy that Biden started, together with, again, a trade policy that is going to punish China. Right. We just have to do it, right? This isn't like what we did basically with China was like a Marshall Plan. Instead of our taxpayers subsidizing, you know, the regrowth of Japan and Germany, which we rightfully did, I think, you know, after the conclusion of World War II, what we basically did is say, you know what, we're going to give our manufacturing jobs away, and China will hopefully become more democratic and more friendly. And the consequences of that are going to take generations to turn around in the United States.
No, because if you look at the 10 areas that the Chinese made in China 2025 did, is AI technology, which, you know, you look at this DeepSeek thing, got everybody freaked out, robotics, aerospace, shipbuilding and maritime equipment, rail equipment, electric vehicles, power equipment, agriculture equipment, new materials, and biotech. They're investing heavily while we're right now slashing and burning virtually every bit of investment that we're doing in the country. Seems like we're going in the wrong direction on everything else. while the tariffs might help, I fear everything else is a total disaster. And I look at what military.com's headline when talking about veterans' data being swept up by Musk at the Treasury Department. It wrote infinite nightmares at once. And sadly, that's where I see us at, all of this chaos, and we're falling further and sadly further behind.
Yeah, reversing those policies that were done in the last administration on industrial policy, huge mistake. I mean, some of them could be improved, no doubt, from the Inflation Reduction Act. There's no question that they could be improved. But just getting rid of all of that stuff would be a major mistake. And there'll be a lot of half-finished factories in the United States if that is exactly what happens.
Sad stuff. But Scott, I appreciate the time, the input. Always good talking with you, my friend.
Rick, great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Scott Paul, President of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Want to hear your thoughts. Do you agree with me? Do we need more domestic production for domestic consumption? Or no, Rick, we just need the cheapest stuff. Get me my big basket of cheap garbage. I'm hooked. I want to hear. Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Right back.
Covering the games and biggest sports news, listen daily to Mike Clemens on Civic Media.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
This Civic Media station is currently broadcasting the Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks over the air. Due to streaming restrictions, we can't provide you the broadcast here. You can find an affiliated station at civicmedia.us to find the game over the air. We'll also have updates on the game and the biggest sports news from Mike Clemens daily on Civic Media stations all across Wisconsin.
The John and Gordy Show.
Go back to an earlier era before the right dominated the national storytelling. You go back to somebody like Frank Capra. He was masterful at telling that story about the little guy, that heroic figure who had nothing but worked hard, looked out for other people, cared about family, and made a better life. And that kind of storytelling has vanished.
Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on 92.7 WMDX.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Got to tell you, I was surprised at the number of responses I got from the idea that Trump was going to actually just pave over the Rose Garden. You know, what's that song? You know, pave over paradise, put up a parking lot. Yeah, evidently he wants to have a, you know, like a paved area like they have at Mar-a-Lago to entertain. You know, no sense in having, you know, roses. Shocked? I'm not even a little bit. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the craziness or as military.com put it. And I tell you, I love the frame. Infinite nightmares at once. It's what we're living through. I've asked my good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So infinite nightmares at once. Military.com's article headed off as they talk about all of the veterans' data that has been swept up in the Musk takeover of the Treasury Department. And a lot of concern about what they're going to do with that data. But it's interesting, that frame, infinite nightmares at once. It's kind of it's apropos for what we're living through.
Well, now I'm old, Rick. So what's the current young generation Z?
Yeah, Z.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I forget.
Zoomers.
Baby boomers. Zoomers. I know baby boomers, and that's the only one I know. So generation Z. And I saw an article today which was really interesting, and it said 30% of Generation Z are now angry at what's happened with the election of Trump. And one of the lines was, don't you realize that's called you need to vote?
Yeah.
versus after effect. I mean, it's so rapid, the change in D.C. And of course, the problem that everybody's going to have, in particular the Democratic side, is twofold. One, some of these, as these items come out, people do say, wow, you know, it's like the $6,000 toilets, right? Years ago and things.
Right.
And people will grab onto that. Now, some of this will then filter out amongst the heartland of America. And then people will say, well, I didn't think this was going to happen. I don't think I want that, but I want this. Well, there's not sort of a choice, you know, when you take a buzzsaw to something, this is what happens. Now, of course, DOGE is not a congressionally established entity, so it can do these things only by relating to the executive, the president. Here's what happens, now you need to lay off. Here's what happens in that agency, now you need to go in and cut. And of course, there's a 1974 Impoundment Act, which was created because of Richard Nixon, just willy-nilly doing away with congressionally authorized programs. That's going to happen again. Now, the Congressional 1974 Impoundment Act, Rick, as you know, is only as valid and is only as capable an act as it can be if it's enforced.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So who enforces it? I'm going to throw that out there. Who enforces it?
Yeah, the executive branch is supposed to, but they're not going to do it.
That's what I'm saying. So there's going to be a series of Supreme Court decisions, but not all of them will go to the Supreme Court.
No, but even still, even if the Supreme Court does decide, do you think this administration cares? Do you think the Musks of the world care what the rule of law is? You know, I saw a post over on Twitter from the real Donald Trump, and he says, "He who saves his country does not violate any law." And you know, he's not just talking about himself here. He's talking about anyone who, as long as you're saving, it's like that whole, you know, the tree of liberty must be watered with the blood of tyrants and patriots. It's that kind of verbiage that gets me to believe that this is more of a call of action to go out and break the law and to break things up, as long as you're doing it, you know, to save the country, of course.
Well, and also there's a lot of moving pieces to this. There's the foreign entity side of it and what we're doing. There's the domestic, and then there's the budget. And the only thing that can make the executive stronger, the White House, is if the congressional side can't come to terms with the budget process, which there isn't even a budget process. These are continuing resolutions.
Right.
Let's remember something. They're working on reconciliation. They're working on, in March, that's the deadline, on fixing what was supposed to happen last year.
Right.
This gives a path wide enough for a Mack truck to ride through for any president. Now, we have a new president. Biden would, you know, have reacted differently, or Obama or Bush. And now we have Trump, who reacts differently than we've ever seen in modern times. But the Congress itself, as long as it cannot function like it's supposed to, this invites executive authority, power, executive actions, and even signing statements, which nobody talks about, where the president makes a signature when he votes on a law, and it tells the agencies not to follow what Congress has passed. This has been going on for a long time. Now it's on steroids.
Yeah. No, it's something we used to talk about a lot during the W. Bush years, and has continued all through. But what do you say? Because obviously the deadline is March 14th, the potential government shutdown. What if Trump just says, you know, I don't believe in a ceiling. I don't believe in you know this. We've cut all this spending. We're not honoring this stuff. We're just going to keep the government open, and don't care what Congress says.
Well, it's going to be an interesting deal of what happens in Congress. Of course, the Senate, I'm not even going to talk about it because they have a margin. It's not real comfortable, but it's comfortable, if that makes sense. They have a margin of votes. They can lose one or two. They can lose Mitch McConnell, you know, whatever. Now, let's talk about the House, though. And for the Democratic side, when it comes to policy, they're going to have to make a decision. Do they want to go along and not have the government shut down? Or do they want to let the Republicans make that decision? And if the government shuts down, it's the Republicans' problem and not the Democratic side's problem. Although I will give this observation, and this is retail politics, and you know, you know it, you've been involved for years, you know, I call it the retail politics, the street politics, and the people politics. And what I'm referring to is the fact that it's not good enough to say oligarchs, democracy's done as we know it. You have to give examples. And on top of it, you have to have an alternative. And that's where the Democratic side has to decide quickly, are they going to be part of an agreement to keep the government open? If they are part of an agreement, is it going to be a wishy-washy agreement where they say, yeah, we don't want to shut down the government? Or are they going to get what they believe, the Democratic side, that their values are? Are they going to get that into a piece of legislation to continue the government? These are some decisions they're going to have to make. If they're not going to go with the Republicans to, you know, quote, save the speaker if he can't get the votes, because his margin's one or two votes, then they have to decide, as the government may shut down, what their answer to that's going to be. Of course, the executive has to deal with it. And let's see how Trump handles it. Frankly, I'm not sure that the Trump administration is going to wring their hands if it shuts down.
No, I don't think so either. But you know, if you're the Democrats, and I agree with you, you've got to come out with that alternative vision. It's what I've been saying all along. The solutions will come out of the suffering of their savagery. The more things that they do, the more things they get away with, the more people are going to be harmed by it, the more it will become clear of what those solutions should be. And Democrats have to go out there and have that vision of what the alternative looks like and stand on those principles. Republicans have done that for years. I mean, you were part of one of the first waves of it with the Contract on America. I put the on America because, again, I think that was the beginning of where we are today.
Well, and look, we had a balanced budget movement. Bill Clinton came willingly or part willingly or whatever, you know, into it and became part of it. In fact, I'll tell you this, Rick, if I heard it once, I heard it 100 times of people beating their fists down in closed door Republican meetings saying, he's getting the credit for it. He's getting the credit for it. Well, he went along with us, or we went along with him, or we went along together, right? But we had this mantra of what we were going to do when it came to balancing the nation's budget. But when we did it, we at least did it by agency, and you had the amendment process, and Democrats did get amendments. And so sometimes we got votes, in the budget process. This time, this is not, and I can't stress this enough, this is not a budget process. This is just, you know, we're going to cut and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. It's not laying everything out to get a chance. It's just saying we're going to rescind $2.5 trillion, which I'm not against the balanced budget, but how are you going to do that? Yeah. Who pays for it? How do you make it work? At least when, you know, Clinton was there with us, we laid it all out, and it was done in the sunshine of what you were going to do. That's not the case now. It's just, you know, who can do what first on these broad scale basis, which really do not work out to say how the government's going to function after that.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what Schumer and Jeffries do as the leadership of the party. It's going to be interesting to see how they handle this, because there are a lot of people looking to them for leadership, and there doesn't seem to be any. There doesn't seem to be any direction, and I think that's a real problem.
Well, also, too, I read an article how a lot of the base, I mean, it's generic, the Democratic base, is flooding the offices with, you know, do something. But if you look at what happened, I mean, people have to not forget this on the Democratic side, I would say. The Republican side, they're surely analyzing it. A lot of people didn't come out to vote on the Democratic side. Yeah. And elections have consequences. So a lot of people may be mad at their Democratic members of Congress, but they, you know, they didn't give them the majority. So it's going to be tough to immediately this year for the Democratic side to do something. So they've got to put their, you know, thoughts together and get on the same page, at least to draw back in people that went another direction. Or I'm just talking mainly about working people.
Yeah, or just stayed home. And one of those issues was, you know, I had a lot of people say, I can't vote for Genocide Joe. And, you know, talking about Gaza and obviously about Ukraine. And now we see Trump has got, he's got plans for Gaza. He's got plans for Ukraine. And I don't think they're necessarily good plans.
Well, Bibi Netanyahu has embraced the Gaza plan because he has two ministers, Smotrich and Gavir, who they want the Palestinians gone. Now, that doesn't mean every Israeli follows that guideline. A lot of Israelis know this would be a very painful process for Israel just to try to move 2.5 million people somewhere else, and it could be a disastrous prospect for Jordan and Egypt, because people say to me, well, why don't they take them? They're Arabs. Well, okay, Germans and English are Europeans, right? Why don't, if something happens, move all of Germany into England? After all, they're Europeans, aren't they? Well, this is the same scenario. There are differences in cultures and people. So as this plan's laid out there and Netanyahu's embracing it, it's interesting to see the dynamics of what's going to happen. Now, in theory, are we going to, United States going to own a piece of land overseas and move 2.5 million people? No. But this is causing a reaction now of people to at least begin to discuss what really is going to happen, and the Arab nations are going to have to weigh into it. And then you have the Ukraine and Russia. You have negotiations starting as we speak in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Mohammed bin Salman, who's not technically the king, but he is the king, is hosting this event, and it'll be between us and Russia. And the comment was made that Saudi Arabia will be an active participant in this entire deal, right? Now, on the other hand, we have our special emissary who's going to the Ukraine to conduct, quote, parallel conversations. Then you have the United Kingdom who said, well, we're willing to put troops on the ground, which maybe somebody should have said that a couple years ago.
Yeah.
We're willing to put troops on the ground to defend the Ukraine. This is England. So you have, you know, this entire strange dynamic. Now, I think generically that President Trump wants two deals. How they come out, I don't know. Remember when he told the Congress, Rick, that he wanted a perfect bill, then later said, but you can have two of them. Well, you can have three of them, as long as he can say, I got something. I think the foreign affairs situation is the same thing. I'm not sure it matters what comes out, but that the Trump administration will be able to say, well, we took care of those two problems. Joe Biden let them sit. We finished it. That's off of our plate. That's what I think's happening.
No, that's part of his thing. And I was reading an article from talking about, it was actually talking about J.D. Vance's speech overseas, and you know how it was not well received. I don't know that you can go into Germany and tell Germans that they're treating Nazis poorly, but that's what he kind of did. But you know, this, I think it was one of the Polish ministers or something, and he was explaining. What he thought Trump was doing. And there's some Russian phrase for what he was saying. It's just you push and you push and you push, and then you settle for something less. And he was basically calling Trump a bully, and that they were going to have to figure out how to poke the bully back in the chest, because I don't know, the globe is going to take 4 years of what we've seen. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see.
Well, look, The first person, of course, to visit was Bibi Netanyahu, you know, and he came out with a brand new plan that even he didn't think of, which is to move 2.5 million people. Even Bibi didn't ask for that, right?
Yeah.
But he came out with it. Then Prime Minister Modi of India, and India is a really great potential ally of ours for so many reasons. They like us. They are a democracy. You know, they have had problems with China. India has. What happened with Modi? Number one, when the illegals were brought back, the Modi government said, okay, they violated American law, bring them back. That's number one. Number two, Modi already started to reduce some tariffs before he got on the plane to DC to arrive saying, I've reduced some tariffs. So there is a world reaction right now to Trump because he will throw out, well, I'm gonna you know, tariff everything you own. Well, okay, well, maybe we better do this and that before we go to DC. So there is that interaction, which is fascinating. And that's why J.D. Vance did what he did. He went over to play the bad guy. This is good guy, bad guy, cop thing, except it's kind of bad cop, more than the follow-up of the good cop. But that's what's going on here, and that's why J.D. Vance, you know, did what he did. Hegseth came out and almost, you know, ruined part of it, but that's, you know, because he has no experience. J.D. Vance was a planned event.
Well, I'm sure it was. You don't go doing that off the cuff. I get that, but at the end of the day, I guess it'll see how this plays out. I'm concerned we're setting ourselves up for a fall.
It could be.
Lastly, I got to get your thoughts on the firings. You know, Trump went through real, and they fired, you know, I think someone said a quarter of most agencies they were supposed to go get. One of them being one of the people who take care of our nuclear arsenal, only to go, oh, gee, we need those people. How can we find them? Thoughts on dismantling government piece by piece by just firing people arbitrarily?
Well, again, what's happened is with $35, $36 trillion debt, and the Congress's inability for years, not just now, but under Bush forward, inability for years, and the presidents, all of them, because we got to remember Trump actually added more to the deficit than Biden did, but Biden added to the deficit. They all do. And both parties do. And when it gets to this level, people are able to, and the Trump administration is able to say, well, we have to do this because the House of Cards is going to fall, so we've got to go in and do this. But they're going to find out there's ways to do things that work and ways to do things that don't work. And some of it may sound good. We're going to freeze out, you know, all of this until you realize, well, we've got to run our nuclear capabilities and we have to have people to do that. So this is going to adjust even without court battles. But I'll go back to the fact that Congress needs to do the budget process again to lay all of these things out. It can't be just, you know, the Freedom Caucus saying cut $2.5 trillion right now, no matter what it does. We didn't get into this mess overnight, and we're not going to get out of it overnight.
No, you're absolutely
and
right.
To make immediate rescissions that absolutely don't take into account how the government needs to function, it's not going to be, it might look nice, it's not going to be the way out of this.
I'm with you. Bob, appreciate the time. As always, good stuff. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1834. That was the day that one of the earliest labor newspapers in the country published its first edition in New York City. The Man was a paper aimed at trade unionists. It sold for only a penny. The masthead of the paper was unique. Images of a plowshare, sickle, rake, an axe, hatchet, a saw, a hammer, an auger, a square, and other tools were combined to spell out the letters THEMAN. The newspaper was short-lived, however. It folded in 1835. But The Man was just one example of a growing number of working-class newspapers. The concerns and opinions of working people were often neglected by the mainstream press. In 1828, the Mechanics Free Press was founded in Philadelphia. The paper declared that the working class are the blood, bone, and sinew of the nation. Its circulation grew to 2,000, but it closed 3 years after it began publishing. 50 labor papers started in the 1820s and early 1830s. Most were printed in industrialized northeastern cities. Perhaps the most well-known paper of the time was the Working Class Advocate from New York City. The paper published working people's news for two decades. The years between 1880 and 1940 are considered the golden age of working class journalism in the United States. Thousands of union and radical papers operated during this era. Many of these papers were published in the workers' native languages as immigrants were a growing part of the American workforce. Many unions published their own newspapers or journals. These papers were a vital part of organizing the labor movement, especially in an era before television and the internet. Today, the labor press continues to be a powerful voice for working people. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick at the Rick Smith Show. So Bob brought up Gen Z. And look, it's easy to beat up on younger generations, as Bob said. I only know about the baby boom generation. Bob's a boomer. I'm a Gen X guy. So again, we all look at each other with a little bit jaundiced eye. I think baby boomers kind of destroyed a good portion of what the greatest generation built. Now, but hey, we can have that argument. What I love is the intergenerational fighting, though. Instead of going, hey, we're all working people, we should maybe all try and figure out how, you know, what works for all of us. Yeah, I don't know. I came across this article over at the Business Insider, and I love these articles, with the headline of, "My dad worked for the railroad and retired on a pension. I didn't know how lucky he was until I planned my own retirement." I didn't know. And it's true. Didn't know. They go through this very short article. It talks about how the father was employed by the railroad, paid into the railroad retirement program, which was a New Deal era program. Thank you, FDR. And it was one of those things that made sure that from the moment you retired to the moment you died, you received a pension. You received a check every month. And when you died, your spouse got a survivor's benefit. And they got that till that person died. It was retirement security. That's what it was. And, you know, this little article talks about how, you know, the father, you know, worked the whole life and, you know, didn't worry about the pension, didn't do any planning, just got to be old enough and retired and the pension was there. Didn't have to figure out how to manage stock markets and risky investments and shysters trying to, you know, sell you, you know, these get rich quick schemes. No, this guy just worked his life and was able to live in dignity once he got to retirement age. And it, as this article said, my dad's pension was enough to cover his cost of living for the 20 plus years he lived after retiring. His pension meant that retirement concerns were off his mind and out of his hands. He wasn't worried about outliving his funds. He wasn't concerned with risky investments, stock market plunges, and interest rates. As far as I can tell, she wrote, he did zero financial planning beyond saving some of his income, but it worked well for him. Sounds like a fantasy scenario to me and those like me. And you go, no, not fantasy, policy. Didn't talk about the fact that this was a government-run program, a policy that was put into place by Democrats and FDR back in 35 to ensure that workers had retirement security. And, you know, maybe they saved a little bit of their own money. Pension, savings, Social Security. Now, the railroad folks didn't get Social Security. That was written out. But they got a very generous pension. Also, because their union fought for good pay and for money to go into that pension fund. This is one of those, I know it sounds like a secret. I know it sounds amazing. But hey, Gen Z, how that was able to happen, and everybody else, it was able to happen because smart policy, strong unions, and workers who understood the value of both. We need to get back there. And these kind of stories, it'd be great if the person writing them would write that in there. That, hey, this was good government. This was strong worker organizing. Might be a good correction. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco, sports director for Civic Media. Right now, we're airing a Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks game over the air, but due to our rights agreements, we're not able to stream those games here. Civic Media might be a newer company, but we are dedicated to providing the best in sports coverage. Our team has decades of experience covering sports right here in Wisconsin. We've got Mike Clements, who covers our state's biggest teams on location and does daily updates on all of our Civic Media stations statewide. Many of our stations have local reporters dedicated to teams in their area, covering their communities dozens or even hundreds of times each year. No matter where you're at in Wisconsin, we are committed to covering sports, especially in the communities that our stations serve. And we put all of our local coverage right here on our stream, so you can go ahead and grab the free Civic Media app so you never miss a game at civicmedia.us/app. You can find the game you're looking for over the air, or you can stay tuned right here on the stream for more news, talk, and conversation. Thank you for listening to Civic Media from all of us here on the sports team.